This young guy, so I did the endodontics for him, and he was happy with it and so forth. And then about, this goes all the way up from about, must be about 8 or 9 years later, or no, about 10 or 12 years later. I was asked to give a talk on endodontics at one of the little study clubs around our area. We used to have these little clubs of 10, 12 dentists would get around, you know, to have somebody speak and so forth. So they asked me to speak on endodontics. And so I see this guy here. He comes over. Hi, hi, you know, and I haven't seen you for a long time. Yeah. He says, IB, I want you to take a look at these x-rays for me. And he shows me a full mouth x-ray. I said, well, it looks like you're pretty good dentistry in here. And I said, there's a first molar up here that the guy had difficulty in negotiating the mesial buccal canal because of the extreme curvature. But even though he didn't reach it, that looks pretty good. He says, you son of a bitch, that's my tooth. So, and here was this guy that was naturally taking the position of focal infection. I think there was really a defense mechanism. It's the fact that they couldn't do it, or didn't know how to do endodontics, or were afraid to do it, and so forth. That's why they took the easy way out: extract a tooth, make a bridge, more money, and so forth. I had one other incident like that down the street from me. There was a man that was a few years older than I was in practice, maybe 15 years longer than I was. And he was a great believer in focal infection. And he had a problem on a lateral tooth. And he came into my office and he wanted me to take care of it. So I said, what do you want me to do with a tooth? And he says, do root canal. I says, I thought you don't believe in it. Oh, he says, that's for the patients. So you see the kind of people that we were dealing with in dentistry, and we still have them today. They talk one way and do another way. And this is also was true in the type of instructors that we used to have in the dental schools, and I'm sure we probably still have, in that they tell the student to do it one way, and in their office they do it a different way. And this was also true some of the people that were doing endodontics in the schools, they would ask the student to do, to take cultures, and in their office they never took any cultures. And of course, again, coming back to the culture bit, the students themselves realized that they were never convinced, but in order to graduate, in order to continue to fill the canal, to finish with the canal, they would put phenol into the brain-heart infusion broth to make sure they got a negative culture. So these are other modalities of dishonesty that existed or exists in our profession. Many of us lack intellectual honesty. I do want to say, mention some people who I feel have had a constructive contribution to endodontics particularly. One, I think, is Appleton. Who was a dentist, but never practiced dentistry. He was a bacteriologist. And although he believed in the concept or the idea of the culture, he himself, I think, in the evidence that he presents, is not very, very strong as far as clinical evidence is concerned. He applies what I would call Talmudic thinking. The other one that I thought that had a very important influence on me, and I still feel that he's made a tremendous contribution, and that's the work of Blaney, where he was able to take these, do apical resections, and show the reactions to the in the apical tissues, and his writings today. His writings of the 1920s, 1926, 28, 24, and thereabouts, if you would erase the date or put today's date on, you would think that he just wrote it in the light of our present knowledge, so that he was quite prophetic.
Dr. Leonard, did you have a personal relationship at all with
him? Well, I met him, you know, at the AAE meetings we had him. And then, of course, reading the literature mostly. Another one that, of course, Coolidge was a very fine gentleman. He was very encouraging to me. He felt that even though that my concepts or my ideas were contrary to his, he encouraged me because he thought it was good in the sense that it had documentation and it had experimental evidence. So at least to me, he typified intellectual honesty. Another gentleman whose work more or less agreed with my concepts or with my rationale, and that was Grove. As a matter of fact, if you read his work, he supports the idea of underfilling in the vital pulp extirpations. Another man that was quite prophetic in his work, and that's Davis of Nebraska. He was our first president of the AAE. And it's very interesting to get his little textbook that he has, it was published in 1945. And he died a few years after that. Quite interesting, some of the things that he has to say. Ostby, I felt, made a terrific contribution in that he was able to develop this technique of getting the apical portion of the root and the surrounding bone and to see what kind of a reaction takes place following certain manipulative procedures, which then Sam Seltzer and I followed, whereby we used these prisoners and whereby we extirpated the pulp and then took a section of that to see what the reaction was. Then we extirpated the pulp and reamed and filed and saw what the reaction was as in regards to time sequence. And then reamed and filed and underfilled, reamed and filed and overfilled and so forth. And we were able to study the periapical reactions. And this, I think, is a tremendous contribution, which I think is worthwhile, because here, for the first time, we have human material rather than dogs or monkeys. People like Summers, Ostrander, and Crowley, they were Crowley was a bacteriologist at the University of Michigan, and Dr. Summers was a very outstanding endodontic clinician. Terrific. Extreme mechanical, very fine mechanical skill. But the only thing was that he was too mechanistic. And I felt that he, to me, had a tremendous impact and influence over the thinking of endodontists in the United States at his particular time. And I felt that he served a particular purpose in that developing a good technique. But I felt that he had too much of an influence that the techniques were not modified to meet the biologic standards. So to me, he typified as an individual that says to me by his work Now you go ahead and disprove him. You have to do something to disprove him. That what he is doing is okay in this particular area. What he's doing in this particular area is okay, but he, that's not the way it should be interpreted. So this to me was some of the motivating factors or people that motivated me into thinking. And also...
Dr. Sowen, I get the impression that he put together a dogmatic type of cookbook.
Yes, exactly.
Cookbook approach.
Yeah. Right, exactly, exactly. And as a matter of fact, the text that he wrote is a text on, how should I say it? I can't think of the proper word for it. It's really not a text on endodontics. It's a.
It's almost like a roadmap.
Yeah, but a guideline, not a guideline. What do they call it? Where the different departments have a particular text that where you open up the canal and how much to go and check it up. Well, I can't think.
When you're describing this, I'm picturing you find the mesiobuccal canal under the mesiobuccal cusp, and you come a little bit. To
yeah,
the
well, they have a, text. Yeah. What's that text called? You know, I can't think of a particular word. Anyway, we'll okay. Get that some other time. But anyway, what I do want to say as far as. Lou Grossman is concerned, he also was an authority, he still is, in certain areas, and he was rather rigid. But I will say one thing for him, and that is that he has the intellectual capacity to change, which I couldn't say much for the others. That may well be that now he's a little bit more mature, and he probably has seen that some of the concepts that he had before need to be modified, and he did modify them. In other words, he was not stubborn about it, and so I feel that he is intellectually honest, and he has the intellectual capacity to change, which speaks very well for him, in my opinion.
So in other words, you're saying that not only did he help the science of endodontics grow, but he grew along with
it. Exactly, exactly, exactly. And so this, I think, is an important consideration. So that takes care of these various personalities. Now, the motivation for development and change, I mean, I gave it to you.
Are there no villains?
Yes, there were many villains. I already mentioned the fact that these so-called authorities in the various schools, I don't want to name them because I would have to name an awful lot of them. And I would have to name an awful lot of current ones because they still haven't changed. They pay lip service to the biologic approach and the biologic considerations. But they themselves haven't changed. Their teachings are still the same. They have this philosophy. I was taught this 35, 40 years ago. It's all right for me. It's good enough for you. And so, of course, I think that there are more villains in dentistry than there are good people. Of course, time will change that because we have, first of all, a much better quality student today than we ever had before, with better background. We also have better teachers in that these teachers have gone on to take graduate work, taken PhDs and so forth. And they are not PhDs in medicine or PhDs in just in microbiology or something like that. They are dentists, PhDs, so that they have the feel and the need, what is essential, what is necessary in dentistry, and they're making the contribution so that we are getting much better students and subsequently a much better dental population as far as average dentists are concerned. You have much better teachers today. Also, you don't have the kind of teachers today that we had in yesteryear where they acted out their aggressions on the students.
A lot of your professional life has been dedicated to intellectual honesty. Do you see that with this new breed of teacher and with this more capable student coming along, do you feel that it's only a matter of time before this becomes more general?
More general. In other words, I would say the greater majority would be on the intellectual honesty level rather than on the charlatan level, if I may use the two extremes. Mm-hmm. I think that the relationship to the of dentistry to medicine today is by far much more acceptable than it ever was. Years ago, the physician would look on the dentist with disdain. What do you know? Don't tell me what to do. Now they realize that the dentist is getting the same quality of basic science training with the same people that are teaching the medical men, their dental men. There's an interrelationship, for example, in meetings with medical people and dental people. And just to again cite you the illustration that I'm again going back to my internship days and the days of my association with the hospital. I remember one time I had a patient who came into my office and I took x-rays on her, and it just didn't look normal. I never saw this situation before, and neither did millions of others, but it just didn't look right. And so I sent her to the x-ray department, and I said, there's something wrong here. I'd like to have a skeletal survey made of this patient. And I said, well, what do you think it is? As if to say, don't bother us, you know, stuff like that. Well, look, I say, the bone pattern appears something like I saw in the pictures of with lipoid dystrophies. Oh, all right. So they take x-rays, and sure enough, they examined the patient, and the patient had Gaucher's disease. And that was when I reported two of those cases. And then there was another situation where the patient had a fracture, and when they took the fracture and so forth, they saw little punched out areas and so forth. And I took some dental x-rays. She also had dental x-rays done. And I said, you know, I said, this looks like similar to the Gaucher's case of the other one. And sure enough, so whenever I asked for a skeletal survey after that, there was never any question, because I established myself, you see. And I think that what dentistry has done, it has established itself in the medical eyes, namely that they have a contribution to give or to make for diagnostic purposes or for the betterment of the patient. And so there's definitely a much better intermedical dental relationship today than ever before. And as a matter of fact, most hospitals today want a dental internship or a dental resident to be on the service. Also, that again, coming back to my dental days at the hospital, where I used to make rounds in the medical wards, and I would pick up cases suspicious of leukemias or a certain anemias and so forth and so on. And this, of course, they began to realize it's the same thing as sending into an ophthalmologist. He looks in the eyes and you got diabetic changes. Well, I can look in the mouth and I can tell you got other kind of changes. Mm-hmm. So this, of course, plays a very important role. And then also the work that we did in the relationship of bacteremias to subacute bacterial endocarditis. As a matter of fact, when we had a meeting in Chicago between the American Heart Association and the ADA as to what the dosages and so forth should be in regards to the use of antibiotics and so forth and the local anesthetics with and without epinephrine, this, that, and the other thing. And here, the one of the interesting things is that in that conference, the editor of the American Heart Association Journal asked me to write an article in the American Heart Association pointing out its relationship and so forth, which again points out that there's a much better relationship. And I think dentistry has made tremendous strides in that respect. And it's not because the physician just wanted him or asked him to come in there. He proved himself he needed him. He needed him. Mm-hmm. And he proved the point that this is another modality which can help the patient. You see? Mm-hmm. And I think the dentistry has earned it. Plus the fact
because
that...
Because certain individuals have...
Yes, of course. Look, for example, Burkitt played a very important mm-hmm. role as far as the interrelationship with oral medicine is concerned. A number of dentists have gone on to take their MD degrees with it, you see. Mm-hmm. And a number of PhDs, although they were teaching in medical school, find that it's just as provocative and just as interesting to teach dental yeah. students too. And there are new, fresh areas. As a matter of fact, in the field of neurophysiology, those that are particularly interested in pain, the pulp is the organ which they need most because the pulp only has pain fibers. Sensory pain fibers. The others have touch fibers. They're interrelated and so forth. So you do not have a pure tissue whereby you can actually test these modalities as far as pain is concerned. And you take, for example, Dr. Scott, Donald Scott. He's a neurophysiologist. And he's interested in pain. He picked on the tooth. You see. And many of the, there are a number of PhDs, theses that I wrote, I mean, that I read, and there they are, doing the very same experiment that Van Hassel did on the monkeys in regards to the fact that the pain fibers can be discriminated in the cerebral cortex, which before that they all doubted. So people like Van Hassel and people like Kim and Edwell and Olgart and Scott are all making contributions in the area of pulp neurophysiology and also circulatory physiology, which is an important factor. We finally cracked the isolation of the pulp, so to speak, because here it is encased in this hard tissue, and it's very difficult to do experimental work. And with their ingenuity and with the sophisticated tools that they have today, they're able to get in there and measure these reactions, which I think is a boon for the development of endodontics, particularly.
Do you see the conflicts, for example, in medicine, these bacterial specialists, infectious disease specialists, a lot of these people, they have such tunnel vision that, you know, any swelling, anything going, they want to hospitalize this patient, put the patient in on IV antibiotics, and really don't have a concept of what we're doing.
Well, no. You mean in regard following endodontic treatment?
Say like any fulminating infection of endodontic origin. They are so geared to hospitalize patients and to use IV antibiotics that they wouldn't even attempt anything PO.
What do you mean PO?
By mouth, antibiotics.
Oh, I see. Well, let me say this. It depends. If it is a fulminating infection, if the patient has swelling, and if the patient has temperature, he belongs in the hospital. And of course, the important thing is to which antibiotic to use, mm-hmm. You see? So he may decide to use, say, penicillin, which is the antibiotic which is most specific to dental infections, and he will use that, and if that doesn't respond, similar to your brother-in-law, he doesn't respond, they change the antibiotic. They haven't been able to isolate the bacteria, have they?
Yeah.
Okay. So they're treating that same way as that. So I don't see any... Of course, let me say this, that unfortunately, endodontists too and general dentists, when the patient has pain, even though they don't have any swelling, right away they give them antibiotics because it's due to an infection, or they give them that, it'll take care of it, you see. And many times it disappears. Well, the effect was strictly a placebo effect, you see. And the history of medicine, the whole history of medicine as far as therapeutics is concerned, this placebo effect. Why do you have all these different drugs coming up all the time? Try this one, you know. Oh yeah, it's better. Then that dies out. Because placebos have a 35% effect, you know, therapeutic effect. So they try that. So that quite frequently occurs in many of these situations whereby they use antibiotics. And actually, in most instances, it doesn't do the work. I mean, if you apply tincture of thyme, T-I-M-E, that is one of the best drugs that you could use, number one. And number two, it's the best thing for diagnosis. And another thing is that I find that dentists and endodontists, they always think that they have to do something. Just sometimes you have to decide to leave it alone. And I think one of the things that I try to strive, I know in my group of students, is to try to make clinicians out of them and not be technicians. Decide when to operate and when not to operate. Just don't go in and for the sake of doing it, you know. And always have a rationale for treatment. If you don't know, don't do anything. Or give it a little time. You may have to go in consultation with somebody else.
Know why and what you're doing before.
Right,
you do
exactly,
it.
Exactly. That's, I think that what we have to do is to really develop a philosophy of treatment. And that's why I say rationale of treatment. Let's see. You have
a few other things on the bottom.
Peer acceptance, peer challenge. We have patient's acceptance and major advances. Is that what you want to?
Yeah, and future endeavors, which I think is very important.
Yeah.
I really would like your perspective on that.
All right. Now, as far as major advances are, a patient's acceptance, the patients accept endodontics today much better than ever before, and that is that I think the public has been taught to keep their own teeth as long as possible. And they like that idea. Also, our culture seems to dictate to keep your own teeth and not to have a full upper and lower denture. That's the dictate of our culture, really. And so that if you tell the patient that you can save the tooth, they'll accept it much more than they did before. Oh, the heck with it, you know? Or what they probably have seen is that their parents had great difficulty with the full upper and lowers, or they didn't look too well, you know, when they took them out and so forth and so on, and they did not want to be in the same position. And they realized that their parents couldn't afford the better dental care to keep their teeth, and they can, so they want to avail themselves. The other thing is, of course, the patients, is the fact that we have developed better forms of anesthesia. We have developed better understanding of the pain and how to handle the patient psychologically. We have more empathy for the patient, and so the patient is willing to accept endodontics, but primarily he wants to accept endodontics. He's accepting endodontics particularly because he can keep his own tooth. I think that's the major consideration.